You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Law Podcast. I'm June Grosso. Every day we bring you insight and analysis into the most important legal news of the day. You can find more episodes of the Bloomberg Law Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and on Bloomberg.com/podcasts. After a series of damaging scandals and leadership changes, Wells Fargo is trying to let the public know it's cleaning up its act, going so far as to air television ads touting the company's reestablishment.
We're holding ourselves accountable to find and fix issues proactively, because earning back your trust is our greatest priority.
Joining us from our studios in Washington is Jesse Westbrook, Bloomberg News financial regulation editor. Jesse, Wells Fargo has had scandal after scandal and has been trying to clean up its act to no avail. Will this time be any different?
Well, an interesting part about that is that maybe there is something accurate of their ad in the sense of they do seem to keep finding things, and they do seem to keep reporting things to regulators.
Yeah. The
message of putting the scandals behind them, however, every day that we see an ad like that, something new seems to come up. I mean, we had this interesting situation yesterday where they were holding an event here in D.C., and just as that event was going on, this story comes out that some senior people were putting false Social Security numbers in corporate client documents that were filed to regulators. And, you know, it was supposed to be one of these events where they're showing people they've changed. And a Republican lawmaker who is actually quite friendly to the banking industry, Jeb Hensarling, got up there and trashed them standing in front of a Wells Fargo banner. So if you can't, if you don't have friends in Washington who are pro-bank, anti-regulation Republicans, I don't know who your friends are.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not as though it's that hard for lawmakers on either side of the aisle to continue to treat Wells Fargo as kind of a political punching bag. But is this a matter of the bank is offering greater transparency now by getting these bad incidents out in the limelight, or is it still committing these bad acts? Has it just not gone away?
Well, I guess I view the Wells Fargo from the perspective of, you know, we talk a lot about too big to fail in relation to banks. I mean, that's obviously an issue. You know, there's arguments in Washington about whether Dodd-Frank fixed too big to fail. Clearly, what Dodd-Frank did not fix is the too big to manage issue. I don't have a great insight to Wells Fargo. I'm not inside there every day. But to the degree that these things keep happening, I mean, you get the sense that now some of it, the people at the top are to blame for it. But some of it, you just get the sense they really just have no idea what's going on inside that bank. And, you know, they're these big bureaucratic apparatuses where the right hand really doesn't know what the left hand is doing. And even if you try to do things to stem to control that and tamp it down, there are so many people, these institutions are so large, they're global footprints. You know, you just can't seem to have everyone rowing in the same direction, so to speak.
So the change in management, has that made any difference?
I mean, I don't. I don't really want to take any shots at the CEO Tim Sloan. I don't know him. I've never met him. I've never talked to him. I will say that you know, sort of observing this less as a journalist and more just as, you know, a member of the public, I'm not sure the contrition has been strong enough with Wells Fargo. And even under Sloan, I'm not sure that sort of message of being contrite has been powerful enough. I mean, you sort of look at these ads and, you know, the last person I really have sincerely believed that Wells Fargo has fixed things is Wells Fargo. I mean, I'm not I that message would resonate more if I had someone who was sort of an objective analyst who spent 6 months in there digging under every rock and told me it's fixed. But sort of the taint of that bank is so strong. I mean, we're supposed to believe them that they've fixed their problems. And meanwhile, we keep getting this evidence every day that they haven't fixed their problems. And back to Sloan, I mean, you know, there's been a couple instances where being contrite probably would have gone further than being sort of the combative way that he has been in some instances. He's been a little combative with the press. You know, he's made some statements at times where, you know, oh, it's the press's fault this stuff keeps popping up. Well, no, it's your fault that you're not fixing the problems. I mean, you know, that's what journalists do. We dig. Mm-hmm. We look for problems. We're rarely reporting that the sun is out today. We're looking
that's
for bad
great
stuff.
Analysis, Jesse.
So you know, we're looking for bad stuff. So give us less bad stuff to find, I guess would be the way I would put it.
You've rolled out the carpet nicely for us to let our listeners know that we will, in fact, be speaking with Wells Fargo CEO Tim Sloan. We'll see if he continues his combative stance with the media when he speaks with Bloomberg Television's Eric Schatz. You can hear that conversation this coming Monday afternoon, 4 p.m. Wall Street time.
But we won't play
Bloomberg
Jesse's
television.
Comments.
Yeah.
We won't play Jesse's comments.
I'm not
going
to hold
interview.
Them to it. We'll see what happens. But at any rate, that's coming up at 4 p.m. Wall Street time.
I was trying to be nice. Maybe
this coming Monday on Bloomberg Radio and TV. Want to switch to another topic that you and your team have been covering at the FinReg team, Jesse. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they're not supposed to be lobbying about whether they should continue to operate, but apparently that admonition isn't stopping Fannie's general counsel. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so good reporter who works for me knows more about Fannie and Freddie than anyone I know. Joe Light had this story about their general counsel going out and meeting with stakeholders, people associated with the Trump administration, and expressing the view that he thinks that the Trump administration should find a solution for these companies on its own, cut Congress out of the picture. Congress has not been able to do anything about these companies for a decade. They continue to sit under the government's thumb. They're sort of in this, you know, purgatory of not really independent companies, but they've got such a huge footprint in the mortgage market. So he wants them to take the bull by the horns and fix this. Now, on the surface, that doesn't sound like a bad thing. I mean, we do need a solution to Fannie and Freddie. It's just sort of one of these things that has enormous implications in Washington and beyond, and no one really has a good idea to what to do about it. And just like everything in Washington, there's no immediate crisis. And unless we have an immediate crisis, no one in Washington is going to do anything. So these massive companies that are basically, you know, cutting to the chase of the argument, propping up the housing and mortgage market, have been in this state of purgatory for a decade. What might be inappropriate about what Mr. Brooks is doing, inappropriate is a strong word, there is awkwardly or, you know, unfortunately, a ban on lobbying at these companies. And that's because people who've been in this town a long time remember before the crisis, there were no bigger lobbying powerhouses in Washington, D.C. than Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Every lawmaker was on their payroll, so to speak, and they had huge galas and breakfasts and, you know, many attempts to regulate the companies and prevent them from growing bigger and bigger were halted. And that was, you know, a lot of people, smart people, smarter than me, think that was largely because of their lobbying prowess.
Jesse, we'll have to stop you there and we'll pick up with this another time. Thanks. That's Jesse Westbrook, Bloomberg News Financial Regulation Editor. In a phone interview with Bloomberg yesterday, Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's lawyer, said that special counsel Robert Mueller has indicated he'd be willing to narrow the scope of an interview with Trump. Speaking on CNN this morning, Giuliani repeated that assertion.
They sent us a response. I can't go into detail, but narrowing the subjects for questioning down to about two.
Joining me is Jimmy Garule, a professor at Notre Dame Law School. Jimmy, sometimes I wonder if Giuliani's real intent is to wear us down with this bouncing ball explanation of what's happening in the case and contradictions about the facts. He's gotten the facts wrong before. How likely is it that Mueller would narrow the interview down to two questions?
Oh, I think it's highly unlikely. Excuse me. And I think it's another example, indication of Giuliani either not knowing what the president's intentions and desires are, or he's just speculating as to what he thinks the president will go along with. And then from day to day, he seems to flip and flop back and forth on these issues. So I think what he says on any given day should be taken with a grain of salt.
Does it seem that the problem is not so much the scope of the interview as the likelihood that Trump, no matter how much prep there is, and it doesn't seem like they're leaving room for much, will contradict himself or the facts, and Mueller may know them as well as Trump?
I think that's the real danger. You hit it right on the head. First of all, Trump has a long history of flip-flopping, exaggerating, misstating, misleading on a number of different issues. And here he's going to go in to an interview with an adversary who's going to be fully informed on very specific details, very specific facts, in which he can rebut and challenge Trump's claims, and I think it's a grave danger, a risk that Trump is running if he agrees to this type of interview.
According to Politico, Giuliani also said he got a verbal assurance from a top Mueller deputy that the special counsel intends to follow a pair of Justice Department legal opinions that say a sitting president can't be indicted. Legal opinions change. There are no specific cases on point.
Correct.
Could that change if, for example, let's say Trump perjures himself in an interview?
It's possible, but I think it's highly unlikely. I think it's clear from the Constitution that the framers envisioned, with respect to bringing criminal charges against a sitting president, that be a political process, not a legal process. And that political process would be the process of impeachment. Again, the caveat there is while the president is sitting in office. Now, once he is removed from office, or he doesn't run for reelection, or he's defeated, he's like any other citizen.
Okay.
And he could be criminally charged for any crime that he allegedly committed.
Mueller's team apparently offered no assurances, according to Giuliani, that the investigation would end shortly after a presidential interview, which is one of Giuliani's demands. What do you make of that? Because the rumors have been, and the talk has been, that Mueller wants to close the obstruction of investigation, but first he wants to hear about intent from Trump.
Well, that's true. I mean, the investigation is on two parallel tracks. The first track is, of course, the issue of whether there was Russia interference in the 2016-11, and more specifically, whether there was a conspiracy between Russian government officials and members of the Trump campaign. And then the second track is the obstruction of justice track, whether the president has taken actions, including the firing of FBI Director, former FBI Director Comey, to obstruct justice, to thwart the investigation. But again, we have to put this in perspective. Yes, it's 1 year. This investigation has been going on 1 year. But let's look at past investigations of presidents, including the Whitewater scandal involving President Clinton. That went on for I think close to 6 years before it was finally concluded. I think 75% of Clinton's tenure in office involved this investigation. This investigation was going on during that period of time. So 1 year, I think, when you put it in perspective, is a relatively short time for this type of very complex criminal investigation.
Yeah, he seems to be moving rather quickly, if you ask me, when you look at the indictments and things.
Yeah.
Let's turn
No, that's true. I mean, if you look at the numbers, we're looking at 19 people that have been indicted or pleaded guilty, and then as well as three Russian companies that have been indicted. So that's a very very robust, substantial track record of investigations, prosecutions in that one-year period of time.
Let's turn to some of the civil lawsuits that Trump is facing. A New York appeals court rejected his request to put a defamation lawsuit by a former Apprentice candidate, Summer Zivos, on hold. And the judge in that case had said in March, when she rejected Trump's request to throw out the lawsuit, no one is above the law. What does that ruling tell you?
Well, exactly that. It's very important. It's very fundamental to American democracy. American democracy is founded on the rule of law, and central to that tenet is that no one is above the rule of law, including the president. And so, like any other citizen, the president can be sued. Like any other citizen, he can be the target of a criminal investigation. Now, at the same time, in fairness, you know, it's important that these civil and criminal investigations do not significantly disrupt the president's ability to govern. But if these investigations can be conducted, especially the civil investigations, in a way that doesn't substantially interfere with governance, then they should be permitted to go forward. And someone who has been harmed should be afforded his or her day in court.
So, Jimmy, we have about 45 seconds here, but does it seem to you as if these civil investigations are almost causing more trouble for Trump than the criminal?
Well, certainly the Stormy Daniels investigation has been, and it's a huge headache for the president. It's been very embarrassing. The president has been caught in a lie. On one occasion, he said he knew nothing about the payment, and then we left to Stormy Daniels this $130,000 payment, only to learn later that, in fact, he did know about it and, in fact, reimbursed his attorney, David Cohen, $100,000.
Right. Thank you, Jimmy, as always. That's Jimmy Garule, a professor at Notre Dame Law School. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Law Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and on Bloomberg.com/podcast. I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.